If you're at all into food, you probably know Flyby Jing Sichuan Chili Crisp. So you can understand how absolutely stoked I am to be talking with Flyby Jing founder Jing Gao today on the pod. Jing has cracked open the food world here in North America with her namesake line of condiments, more than just chili crisp, by the way. And her journey from business school graduate to CEO of all things flavor is a story of reclaiming identity and living your passion that is so incredibly inspiring. Hello, friends. My name is Desiree Nielsen, and you are listening to the All Sorts podcast, where we're on a mission to make wellness not suck. I started this podcast because I wanted to create a space where you could access evidence-based, positive, and actually useful information about taking care of yourself. And as a cookbook author and heck, just someone who really loves food, I think that way too often in wellness, we completely forget to actually celebrate food in all its forms and the pleasure that it brings to our lives. And if you're sensing a theme between now and the last episode, yeah, we are in it. Because food isn't just about nutrition. It's about culture, connection, and yes, joy. And today's conversation is going to take us all sorts of places, from Jing's nomadic childhood to working for BlackBerry in Beijing. Remember when people had BlackBerries? To the flavors of Chengdu's kitchen, to the trade show floors of Los Angeles. Jing shares how food became a vehicle for reconnecting to her cultural identity and how she's on a mission to elevate consciousness through flavor. Jing has a brand new book, The Book of Sichuan Chili Crisp, that you're going to want to read cover to cover. I know you're going to love every moment of this conversation, whether you're interested in food, entrepreneurship, or self-discovery. So let's dive in. Jing, I am so excited to talk to you. When I got your cookbook in the mail, I was like, I was giddy because I've been such a fan of your brand for a while. And of course, being in Canada, you know, I would like go down to the States and like go to Whole Foods and like lovingly carry your chili crisp home in my suitcase. So it's really nice to have an entire book from you.
Thank you so much. Thanks for the kind words, and I'm excited to chat with you.
I love hearing a little bit about everybody's origin story, and you know, particularly for you with your background and like not starting out in food, but I like kind of want to start by going all the way back, because I know for me, and I think for so many people, food plays such an important part of our childhood memories and like what we believe our family and our culture to be. Like, so much of that comes through food. And in the book, you talk a lot about the fly restaurants of your childhood. And I wondered if you could share a little bit about that with us.
Yeah, for sure. So I was born in Chengdu, which is the flavor capital of China. It's the capital of Sichuan province, which is known for its spicy, but really flavorful, complex, deep cuisine. I was born there, but grew up moving around a lot because my family's job. So I moved to Europe when I was about 5 and then moved to a different country almost every year. And then we eventually settled in Canada and I went to high school and university here. It was usually just like really on trips back home to visit our family that I got reacquainted with Chinese food, because when we were living in all these different countries, we didn't have access to the ingredients. My mom couldn't really cook, so her cooking became sort of a mishmash of whatever country we were in. But when we would visit my grandparents and cousins, I just remember these delicious flavors, you know, whether we were eating at home or going out, and usually we went to these hole-in-the-wall restaurants that are called fly restaurants. And it's kind of a characteristic of Chengdu. Chengdu is an incredible city. I think it's got like almost 30 million people, and every single person is a foodie, is food obsessed. And there's food everywhere. There's all kinds of food. There's like, you know, fine dining. There's home style cooking. There's street snacks. And then there's this type of restaurant called fly restaurants, which are usually hidden, hard to find, run down, but they are so sought after and people will go to all lengths to find them because of how delicious they're known to be. So people are said to be attracted to these fly restaurants like flies. That's where the name comes from. And so I always loved those restaurants because it felt like so dynamic. The energy was amazing. It was an equalizer in a lot of ways. A lot of people were always, you know, you could see people from all different backgrounds sort of sharing a table just in pursuit of flavor. And that was like the first sort of memory of amazing Sichuan flavors. And a lot of those dishes featured, you know, chili oils that were so diverse. And, you know, every restaurant, every family would have their own version. So that made kind of a very early mark on me. And then when I returned to China to work in my 20s, that sort of got reawakened, or, you know, those flavor memories got reignited in me.
You know, and you mentioned moving around a lot as a child. Like, what was that like for you?
It was interesting. It was exciting, but also annoying. And, you know, whenever I would get used to a school or a set of friends or even a language, you know, we would move to the next place and have to kind of redo everything. And it started, you know, I think I got used to it, started to become normal. But definitely, I think I didn't realize until much later kind of the impact that it had on me. But at a very young age, at like 5 or 6, I decided that in order to not stick out more than I already did, which, you know, I was always the only Asian kid in a school, that, you know, by having a Western name and adopting a name like Jenny would really help me, you know, blend in, not stick out. And that became my sort of identity for, you know, almost 30 years of my life. And it was kind of a shield maybe to help me adapt to country and, you know, country from country to country. And yeah, that kind of stuck with me until much later, until after I you know, until just a couple of years ago, actually. So yeah, so I think there was a lot of just like trying to blend in and having to do a lot of code switching. Yeah. But it was really, you know, rewarding and exciting to see so much at such a young age and, you know, be exposed to so many cultures and, you know, have the empathy for so many different types of people. And, but I think eventually when we moved to Canada, I really appreciated that as well, because, you know, my school in Canada was so diverse and very different from the schools I grew up in Europe. So I felt a lot more comfortable and accepted. Yeah. So definitely an interesting journey. And I feel like it made me very resilient.
And do you also feel that, you know, because I find it so interesting, I moved around a lot until I was about 12 too. And I wonder for you, particularly because also then becoming an entrepreneur as part of your destiny, which is a very like, oh, I can do this. Like, I can do this thing myself. Like, do you feel that moving around a lot really sort of increased this idea of like, it's on me, you know, I need to be self-reliant. Like, I need to make things happen for myself.
Yes, absolutely. I'm also an only child. And, you know, my parents, yeah. Yeah, exactly. So I think, you know, my parents were always working. And I think, yeah, at a very young age, I was on my own a lot, feeling very independent. And then later on, it definitely translated to like, this sense of, I don't know, just that I don't need anything or anyone. And which, you know, I've it could also go in the unhealthy kind of direction. But I do think that with kind of, you know, maybe hubris or bravado, like led me to really, and a strong sense of like willpower, I think led me to, you know, pursue the path of entrepreneurship that I did. And kind of, you know, also, because entrepreneurship is a very lonely journey. So I think it prepared me for that.
And yet you started out on like a really different path too, you know, because you went to business school. So I'm wondering, like, even before then, like when you were younger, like what did you think you wanted to do when you were an adult?
I don't know. I think I changed my mind a lot, but I've recently found a scrapbook that I made when I was like 8, where I said that I wanted to become a CEO when I grew up. And I'm sure I didn't know what that meant or like what, you know, a CEO of what. I didn't specify. So I think I don't know where that came from, but I was really, I think, creative as a kid. My dad was a scientist, but he also was a great artist. And so he exposed me to a lot of art. But when I, you know, really wanted to kind of pursue that later on in high school and stuff, the answer was like, no, you cannot go to art school. You know, you have to, you know, go down this very traditional path. And I think I eventually chose business school only because like a friend, you know, my parents' friend's daughter, this older girl I looked up to, she was going to business school. So I had no idea what that entailed either. So it just seemed like, a more acceptable thing to do than go to art school, which is what I really wanted. So I think I just like, I wasn't so thoughtful about it after I went to business school and kind of, you know, went with the flow a little bit. In business school, they kind of teach you that there's only two options for you when you come out. You can either become an investment banker or a management consultant, and that's it. So, delightful. But I thought that was a bit strange, and I really hated the competitive nature of business school. But again, I think I found some kind of compromise. So then I found this job with Procter & Gamble, which was brand management, which seemed a bit more interesting, but it was still a very corporate kind of environment. So I ended up working there when I first graduated. I graduated in 2009, and around then, you know, tech was starting to boom, and BlackBerry was actually the number one smartphone in the world at the time. And so I took a job with BlackBerry and went into tech, and that was really exciting because it gave me an opportunity to move to Asia, where they were really dominant globally at the time, and Asia was exciting for me. I had done an exchange semester with my business school and a school in Beijing, and I just fell in love with the energy of the city and with everything China, and especially modern. It was very different from what I had remembered as a kid. So I went down this corporate path, really not knowing where it would lead, but I did sort of become more interested in entrepreneurship after business school, because that was like the only class I really enjoyed. And so, and then through my experience in the corporate world, I realized that I really didn't want to work for anyone else. But I didn't know what I wanted to do yet. I just knew that I wanted to kind of do something of my own. So,
and then, you know, through landing in China, you decided to start a restaurant?
Yeah. So that was kind of also something that was never planned. It was kind of a gradual realization as I took step by step. But I was in China with my job with BlackBerry. And, you know, that was my first time in China as an adult. It was really eye-opening, and also kind of I was confronted with like this sense of, you know, who am I? Like, am I Canadian? Am I, you know, Western? Am I Chinese? I didn't really know where I quite belonged. And I think in search of that answer, I grasped at things around me. And for me, food became a vehicle for self-discovery, for self-expression. And for me, you know, it started out just from curiosity, because the food that I was experiencing was so good and so different from what I thought Chinese food was growing up in the West. And the more I studied that, the more I wanted to share it with the world. I started a blog and, you know, would take chefs around China when they would come to visit, and doing food tours and, you know, TV shows and things like that. And then, you know, then I think I realized I really just wanted to dedicate my time to that. And it was out of kind of a personal desire, I think, to reconnect with my identity and roots. But it also then became about the kind of shining a light on the culture and the cuisine, and kind of changing the way that people saw it, because I thought it was, misrepresented in the West. So decided to quit my job and open a restaurant to share the flavors with more people.
Can we talk a little bit about Sichuan cuisine in general? Like, and what really, I love that you call it like the flavor capital. That's amazing. And so like, what really defines it and sort of sets it apart from like some of the other regional cuisines?
Yeah. So Sichuan is known for very bold, very kind of dynamic flavors. And they're known for different flavor profiles. So the chefs in Sichuan can use limited sets of ingredients, but create like dozens and dozens of different flavor profiles. And that's what they're known for. And a lot of these flavor profiles happen to be, you know, take the form of sauces and stuff that you can kind of apply to many different canvases. The most famous of the flavors is known as mala, which means spicy and tingly. And that's usually made with, you know, chili peppers, which gives you the heat, but also Sichuan peppers, which gives you the numbing sensation on your tongue. So that's like the most popular one and most well-known one, but there's also like 20 plus other flavor profiles. Sichuan is, because of its location, it's flanked by mountains, it's in sort of a valley, it's very humid, the landscape is very fertile, and so there's just incredible ingredients grown in Sichuan, and really great like kind of protein and vegetables. And so together with the flavors, and a lot of the flavors are, you know, do skew spicy or, you know, feature heat. And that's because of a response to the climate, because it is so muggy and humid. According to traditional Chinese medicine principles, you know, having heat through things like chili peppers and ginger and, you know, other kind of spices like that will help you dispel that heat internally, because a lot, you know, food is very intertwined with like medicine in Chinese culture. So that's also why, you know, there's this love for heat. But yeah, it's just interesting because the chili pepper wasn't actually even introduced to China until a couple hundred years ago via Mexico. But before then, there were other kind of spices and aromatics that they used to do the same thing.
You know, I love, you know, just what you said about like the chili pepper coming from Mexico. I think there's so many or like ingredient origins that people aren't really familiar with. Like a great example is like tomatoes in Italy, right? Or even pasta in Italy. Like those two things that are considered such staples of Italian cuisine did not come from there. Like tomatoes came from the Americas, the noodles, you know, came via Asia. And people forget that, you know, from a very, especially because now we're so globalized, like from very early on in our like origins as peoples, like we have been trading and moving. And yeah, I love sort of like tracing back, like where did this come from? And like, how did this come into a cuisine?
Yeah, I think so. All cuisines are so dynamic and have evolved so much over time. And that's what we forget when we are just in the moment and we're like, oh, this thing needs to remain exactly the way I remember it. Otherwise, it's not authentic in my memory, right? But when you zoom out and you look at kind of the history, the long, long, long history of these cuisines, you see that it's constantly been evolving. And in fact, if it doesn't evolve, then that means something dies. So it has to evolve. And so I think this reluctance by a lot of people to let go of something, you know, and to let go of control of something is interesting. But it's, you know, I've always thought that that was not appropriate. And it was much more exciting to see kind of the way that people would push a cuisine forward by just trying something new and applying their own personal lens to it.
And you talked a lot in the book about how you would host these pop-up dinners as part of this like food evolution in your business, and like packing a suitcase of ingredients for your pop-up. So I would love for you to talk a little bit more about like what you packed in there in terms of like ingredients, because of course, you know, we all know and love your chili crisp. So what else was in there?
Yeah. So before I started bottling my chili crisp, you know, I would bring the ingredients and then just make it, because the chili crisp was like a layer of flavor in a lot of my dishes. And, you know, so there's 18 ingredients in there. There's different types of chilies. So after the chili pepper came into China, it really took off, particularly in Sichuan, not so much in the other provinces, but in Sichuan, it really did. And so they then took it and adapted it and grew different, you know, new variations of chilies that were unique to the region. And They were also really good at cultivating chilies for different properties, like, because in Chinese cuisine and Sichuan food, like, it's a lot of different aspects of taste are prized. So everything from fragrance to like the way it looks, the color, the taste, and then also like heat level and, you know, all kinds of things. So different chilies were cultivated for different reasons. And so there's a blend of like three that we typically use. The most popular one is called Arjingtao chili. It's really mild, but it's like ultra fragrant. So it just really is the dominant chili used in Sichuan cooking. And then, you know, you can also add a little bit of chilies that are known for its heat level to kind of make it a bit spicier, but they might be lacking in like the fragrance department or whatever. So you kind of blend your own and then, you know, Sichuan pepper, which you can't do without in Sichuan cooking, that there's like many different grades. And, you know, for a while it was even illegal to import Sichuan pepper into the West, into certain countries, because of something with like, I think there was a belief that there was a tree, like a tree in the family of Sichuan peppers that had some kind of, I don't know, thing that the government didn't want to infect the other trees here in the West. But that was later lifted. But as a result, you know, there just wasn't a steady stream of Sichuan pepper being imported in. And there was, and the ones that were had been sitting for a long time and just were not so good. And, you know, with spices, there's so many varying grades of quality, and there's such a precise way that you need to store it. Otherwise, it just loses all its potency. And so there really wasn't anything of quality. And even within China, like, there's many different varieties. There's many different grades. And also the processing of it is really important. So to get rid of impurities and all kinds of things. So I had found a source in a town outside of Chengdu that's famous for the quality of its Sichuan pepper. And it was so good that it was once given as a tribute to the emperor. So it's called tribute pepper. So I was using it in my cooking, and it was super rare, super high quality. But even within China, you'd have a hard time finding it. So definitely you wouldn't have it anywhere else. So ingredients like that, and then fermented black bean, which is a really essential ingredient in Sichuan cooking, which is really kind of a time-honored sort of craft that's considered, you know, a preserved artisan craft in Sichuan. Same with doubanjiang, which is fermented fava bean paste. It's a type of fermented chili paste that is made with fermenting fava beans and the Arjingtao chili I was talking about earlier, together with salt. And, you know, it can be aged for several months, which is what a lot of the versions available in grocery stores are, or it could be aged for several years, which gives it a much more complex and deep flavor. And so that's the one that I was able to find from like a centuries old, you know, factory that's been just making it the traditional way and aging it for 3 to 5 years. And so that doubanjiang I found was just really transformative to your cooking, whether it's like mapo tofu or twice cooked pork. And these are very classic Sichuan dishes. So doubanjiang is often called the soul of Sichuan cuisine. So those, you know, would be some of the ingredients. And then eventually I started creating sauces like the Sichuan chili crisp and zhong sauce and things, which were, you know, I would pre-make them. So it'd be kind of shortcuts to flavor when I would do my pop-ups and, you know, bring it with me in containers. And people started then asking for the sauces just on their own. And that's kind of how I started to, you know, sell the sauces.
You know, what was it like? Like, what year did you start Fly by Jing?
So it started out as an underground supper club in 2017.
And at what point were you like, okay, so we are going to bottle this? And like, you know, you had worked for P&G, so, you know, presumably you had some like insight into like a consumer packaged good, but like, what was it like actually being like, okay, I'm going to do this. I'm going to take these incredible ingredients and I'm going to like package them and then sell them to the US.
Well, I was traveling the world in like 2017, 2018, just doing these dinners and kind of spreading the flavors and sharing the flavors with more and more people. And I realized how much people really, you know, universally loved these flavors because seeing their instant reaction, I knew there was something very special there. And of course, like, I mean, Sichuan cuisine is amazing. And I knew that, but seeing people's faces light up when they tasted it was really like confirming of that. So I started thinking about, you know, how do I make these flavors more accessible, more easily accessible? And so, you know, started jarring them in Shanghai, like just making it in my kitchen and selling it to local shops and gifting it to friends and family. But then in 2018, I was traveling through the U.S. and I attended a trade show, a food trade show, where a lot of buyers of grocery stores are looking for the next best thing they want to bring into their retail shelves. And I walked around for a few days just kind of seeing what was available in the U.S. market and didn't really see any modern Asian food brands. And that was really shocking to me because I knew that a lot of the growth in, you know, natural food was expected to be coming from diverse flavors and a lot of heat and spicy foods, but there was no representation there. This was all, you know, but it was all like the trends that were forecasted by, you know, the food industry. And there was no representation in the products and also in the people that were walking kind of in the trade show. So I thought that was definitely kind of a mismatch because of what I saw. Like I saw that people loved, you know, these flavors. And that was when I decided to go back to Shanghai and try to figure out how do I scale the production of the sauce, which took quite a long time. I would say many months of, you know, calling every factory that I could find by searching online and, you know, looking on grocery store shelves to see like who had similar products and whether I could contact their factories. It took a really long time, but eventually I was able to find a couple of manufacturers that were willing to take it on. And then I set up a Kickstarter to see what the demand might be for something like this in the US. So that summer I launched the Kickstarter and, you know, told the story of what I've been doing the last 10 years in Asia, what my mission is, which is really to showcase Chinese food in a new light and, you know, in kind of and have it demand the value that I felt like it deserved. And, you know, told kind of the world about this chili condiment, which I grew up with. And, you know, there's millions of different versions in China, but it's, you know, it's definitely the number one hot sauce in China for a good reason because it is so versatile and goes with so many things. But really, it wasn't very known at all in the West at the time. So that was a Kickstarter, and I was, you know, kind of surprised but not surprised that it did very well. But, you know, thousands of people kind of backed my Kickstarter and signed on to pre-purchase the sauce that they hadn't even tasted. But I think they just like really believed in what my mission was. So that told me that there was definitely a market. Yeah, then I got to work, started producing the first big batch at scale and got to work sort of moving, creating the business in the US, moving to California where I now live. And that was all at the end of 2018, so about 5 years ago. I chose the US because I, you know, through my work in food media, I knew that the US, you know, sort of media landscape dictates a lot of how we view things globally, and wanted to start there to change perspectives and tell the story and through flavor. And I moved to Los Angeles and just kind of started out with a online website because after being at Expo West, I knew that, you know, there was no way I could penetrate that ecosystem. It seemed very impenetrable. The retail landscape, you know, I'd heard was very difficult. It's very costly to put your products in stores. So I had no other choice but to build a website and just start selling it. So that's what I did. And, kind of started from there in early 2019 and grew from word of mouth. And, you know, there was definitely, I think, a lot of support from the beginning, a lot of excitement about the product, and the initial Kickstarter backers, when they tasted the product, they were very excited and told their friends and family. And, you know, it grew very organically in the very beginning, and but slowly, because there was no, you know, I had no investment behind me. There was like literally no way to kind of reinvest in that growth. And so it was very, very slow and organic at first. It sort of started to take off after a couple of years in COVID.
And what was that like? You know, because you've made now the leap, you can find your products in stores. And I know the industry a little bit because my very first job was in grocery, and I know that grocery is overwhelmingly run by older white dudes. Like, you know, creating this product, like, did you experience a lot of pushback of being like, you know, like, I don't know about this. Is this like a household thing?
Yeah, definitely. Initially, it was from just, you know, investors and people who I was, you know, seeking help from. A lot of folks just did not believe that a Chinese hot sauce was broad enough to have broad appeal, or that even Chinese food was had enough broad appeal. I was told many times that it was too niche. Yeah, and so it just seemed like nobody believed in the potential of this as a business. But also, you know, we had a lot of supporters and people who loved the product, but also there was a lot of pushback from others who, like we talked about earlier, you know, refused to accept a product that was not, that didn't fit into their very narrow set of personal experience. So, you know, a lot of people who were like, well, this is not Chinese food, because I've been to China once and I know what Chinese food is. Or, you know, Chinese food is, everyone knows Chinese food is supposed to be cheap. Like, how dare you charge, you know, $15 for a jar of this sauce, even though, you know, we explained exactly why we were charging a premium price for this very premium product that contained, you know, 18 premium ingredients that were sourced in Sichuan. And there's a lot of, you know, resistance, I think, at first, and still to this day. But I think, you know, what we would always respond with is, you know, we would back it up with, you know, the quality of the ingredients, but also, you know, stand firm in the fact that this is a very personal expression of a product where there's literally thousands of other versions in China, and all of those versions have a place and deserve to exist, you know. And I think we started to sort of change minds, like, one by one, and also do it in a way that, you know, was inviting, but also sort of held up a mirror to people's unconscious biases and, mm-hmm. you know, asked the question back to them, like, why do you think that, you know, Chinese food deserves to be, it should be cheap, and that Chinese people do not deserve to profit from their craft? And, you know, I think that approach really, really helped us. And we started to have, like, our customers kind of speak up on our behalf. And, you know, when they really understood and knew exactly what we were about. And I think that's kind of how we grew.
And, you know, grew and grew to the point where you have, like, this beautiful book in homage to the thing that you've built, and also in homage to, you know, this cuisine that has been such a formative part of, like, your life, and now this business that you've created. One of the things that I love most about, I mean, obviously it's gorgeous, obviously the food is delicious, but, like, there's also a lot of story interwoven throughout the book. And in terms of what you were hoping to share with others, like, what was sort of your motivation or your mission in terms of, like, how you shared story in the book?
My mission has always been to evolve culture through taste and flavor. And, you know, I think a lot of our work, you know, it wasn't something, again, that I had planned on in the beginning, but the more we did it, the more I realized that what we were actually doing was also expanding people's palates, people's minds, and in so doing, also elevating consciousness in a way. When people when people's palates get exposed to new flavors, and especially these, you know, very complex, deep flavors, they can never go back. You know, once you've had it, you can't go back. And same with your mind. Once you are exposed to new thoughts, new ideas, you can't go back to, you know, being closed-minded. So it does elevate consciousness in a lot of ways. And it has served, I think, in the last few years in America to really shift the landscape of how people eat. I mentioned that trade show in 2018 where I shockingly didn't see any representation of Asian foods. And now it's very, very different. And we've played a very instrumental part in changing that and to encourage, you know, others to come into the food world as well. And, you know, and I'm very supportive of all of these founders. And, you know, we support each other. We understand it's a rising tide that lifts all boats. And that has become like the biggest driving force. And, you know, I think that all of this is most effectively conveyed through a very personal story, because I think there's universality in like how specific your and personal your story is. And we've seen so many people gravitate to our brand, to our products, to our mission and our story just through me sharing. And my journey has been very, my personal growth journey has been very intertwined with the growth of the company. In this process, I think I mentioned earlier, I reclaimed my birth name, Jing, because I was able to find the strength to, you know, stand firm in who I am and who the company is, and not feel the need to explain or justify, you know, our right to exist to people who had told us previously that we didn't belong. So that gave me the strength to kind of reclaim my birth name, and which was the first step towards reclaiming my voice and my identity. And I think that's very relatable to folks, even if they didn't have the exact same experience. So to me, it was important to, through this cookbook, have another avenue to tell the story and tell my very personal story, but also, you know, through the lens of this condiment, which I think is really magical and a perfect vessel for self-expression, and just also happens to be delicious. And so I think everyone can sort of find something in this book that they can connect with.
That's so beautiful. And as people are exploring it, I always love to ask, it's an unfair question, but I always love to ask, like, what recipes do you think people should start with when they're on their own journey with this book?
Yeah. So there's a section all about condiments in this book, of course, because it's all about Sichuan flavors. And we have our chili crisp, we've got our zhong sauce, we've got a mala spice mix. And a lot of these sauces and condiments actually then, you know, go into all the recipes in the book. So you have the option to make them the way that I used to when I was doing my dinners. And then you have it on hand and ready for kind of a shortcut to a lot of these dishes. Or you can, you know, buy our products through flybyjing.com. And those products are not only a shortcut that you don't have to make yourself, but it also gives you access to the flavors that you can only get if you source those specific ingredients from Sichuan. Because, you know, just because you have a recipe, you know, you'll still yield a completely different result for a sauce depending on what ingredients you're sourcing and using, right? So a Sichuan chili sauce will be very different from a Mexican, you know, chili that you use. And so that is something to keep in mind, that, you know, just because you have the recipe doesn't mean it'll taste like the products that Fly by Jing has. And that's, you know, more of the region of Sichuan. But I would start there and then, you know, start with a Sichuan pantry. And then there's so many really accessible, easy, simple dishes. There's a cold sesame noodle dish that is really easy and you can prepare way in advance, and it just gets better the longer it sort of sits. My favorite recipe is the mapo tofu recipe. That's like my favorite dish ever. And it also is so easy. It comes together in 5 minutes as long as you have the right ingredients. So the key ingredient in that one is doubanjiang, the fermented fava bean paste, which we also sell like the highest quality version of. And then if you have that and the chili crisp, it just comes together so easily. But there's a lot of really interesting, you know, recipes in the book, including desserts and cocktails And, you know, not everything also uses Sichuan chili crisp. It also, you know, features just other flavor profiles that Sichuan's known for. So a lot of these dishes were ones that I cooked when I used to have the Underground Supper Club. So I would call it Sichuan soul food, you know, because I think it's very soulful, it's very comforting, and it's very kind of versatile. You know, once you have a command of the traditional like flavor profiles and those ingredients, you can then kind of just apply it to whatever canvas you want. So I have a Mapo Ragu kind of hand-torn pasta dish. So you can make that Mapo Ragu, but you can apply it to any canvas. You can make a lasagna out of it if you wanted to, you know, so it's really just up to you.
Okay. I feel like that's the perfect place to maybe like shift into the rapid fire questions. So five little questions, little softballs. First, sweet or savory?
Savory.
Best thing you've read this year?
I love Joe Dispenza. So he's a doctor and a psychologist. So Becoming Supernatural by Joe Dispenza.
On the list. Okay. Morning Bird or Night Owl?
Morning Bird.
Some of your other fave brands?
I love, there's so many amazing Asian brands now in food and beverage. I love Imi. It's a kind of healthy instant ramen, revolutionizing the ramen industry. Boxu, a Japanese snack brand. Nguyen Coffee Supply, the first Vietnamese Robusta coffee brand in America. Yeah, those three probably.
Last one. What you, someone who owns this incredible flavor business, someone who just wrote a cookbook, what you make at night when you're super tired and really can't be bothered?
Oh my gosh. This is embarrassing. I would probably just air fry a corn dog. I always have a corn dog in my freezer. And yeah, I would air fry it and then put tons of hot sauce all over. My fridge is basically all condiments.
And that's why everything tastes so good. That's probably my favorite answer I've ever received to that question. So well done. Jing, thank you so, so much for sharing your work and sharing your story with us on the All Sorts podcast. I'm so excited for everyone to pick up your book and start cooking.
Thank you so much for having me. This is fun.
I gotta say, I feel so lucky to get to have these conversations on a daily basis. But getting to sit down with Jing was extra special for me, as I've been such a fan of her brand and what it represents for years now. Fly by Jing is changing the conversations we have around Chinese cuisine, expanding palates, and expanding opportunities for others in this space. And I promise you, you will absolutely fall for her new book, The Book of Sichuan Chili Crisp. So grab a copy from your local bookshop or request it at your library and get cooking. Thanks so much for listening to this episode of the All Sorts podcast, which is produced by myself and edited by Brian McCallman. We are grateful to live and work on the unceded and ancestral territories of the Squamish, Musqueam, and Tsleil-Waututh peoples. If you love this episode, consider sharing it with someone you think wants to hear it, and be sure to hit subscribe so you don't miss a single episode of the pod. Until next week, friends, be well.